Are you going?
Yeah.
Yes. I think we ended with can charge almost anything he wants to for endodontics without getting much reaction from the patient in terms of an argument about the fee. Patients are really willing to spend almost any amount of money to save their teeth. Now, this, of course, doesn't apply to every patient, but educationally speaking, patients are now aware of the fact that their teeth can be saved, that they don't have to have them extracted, and that's why endodontics has literally burst out at the seams. Endodontists are able to open up and successful practices almost anywhere in the United States and charge almost any fee that they wish, and we know from a practical standpoint that endodontists do very well financially. But that shouldn't be the reason why people go into the field. I think they should realize that they are doing a tremendous service for their patients by saving teeth, because as you well know, the loss of teeth has tremendous psychological impact on the patient. And unfortunately, this is not stressed enough in the dental school curriculum. What does it mean for a patient to lose a tooth or teeth? We now know from various studies, psychological studies, from various psychiatrists who have been interested in this area, that the loss of teeth means an aging. The patient begins to feel old. And in a way, there's a sense of bereavement when the tooth is lost. Patients feel a loss of libido. They feel sexually impotent. They feel that they're losing aesthetically. Their appearances change. And all of these factors, plus probably a good many other hidden psychological factors, are present, so that the service of saving teeth can be far more important, almost, than many of the services that are supplied by the physician. Now, I'm not comparing the saving of a tooth with the treatment of a patient with a coronary infarction or anything like that, of course, which is a life-saving situation. But I think dentists don't ever realize just how valuable their services are. And it would be valuable for the dental educators to incorporate in the dental school curricula courses which would bring out these factors. And I think dentists would have a better image of himself as compared to his counterpart, the physician. Dentists, I think, traditionally, and maybe I'm speaking my own feelings and not reflecting those of my colleagues or my peers, but maybe I am, and maybe I'm not, I mean. But my feeling is that dentists generally feel secondary to physicians, possibly because they're not engaged in life-saving situations, possibly because the medical curriculum is so much more in-depth than the dental curriculum, but primarily because they view themselves as mechanics more than diagnosticians. And secondly, because they don't quite realize the tremendous impact of saving teeth. And if that were brought about, if they could realize the value of the service that they perform for patients, I think the dentist would have a greater image of himself. He would not feel as a second-rate citizen compared to a physician, and he would be able to hold his head up high. I think this is in the future in dental education, at least I hope it is, although I don't want to get involved in what's happening to dental education at the present time. I think it's a disaster, frankly, with government intervention and government urging us to turn dentists out faster and reduce the basic sciences and turn out very clinically competent dentists, not endodontists. And perhaps that's a Freudian slip. And maybe I ought to go into that, but I won't at the moment. But I think what's happening is that we're beginning to turn out a lot of competent clinical people, but mechanically competent. And I don't like that kind of a product. I'd like to have a man feel that he's biologically trained, that he's part of the health service, and that he's also doing a tremendous service for the patient. And if that's the direction we go, I think we'll feel good about it. If we go the other way, we're going to turn out denturists, which the American Dental Association is fighting against. But that's another tack. I don't know if we want to go into that, do we?
No, I don't think so, Matt. You mentioned that when you started out that patients never argued about the cost of saving teeth in comparison to other dental services. When you first started doing endodontic procedures, what were the type of fees and what were their relationships, say, to salaries that were paid to assistants and general costs?
Well, in the early days in Philadelphia, when I first went into endodontics, the fee scale was exceedingly low. We were getting something like $35 for an anterior tooth and about $50 for a molar. Dental assistant salaries at that time were in the $60 to $70 per week category. Philadelphia fee scale, incidentally, was not representative of the nationwide fee scale in endodontics because other communities where the fee scales were higher. In New York, for instance, they had a fee scale, we'll say, of $50 for an anterior and $75 for a molar. And quickly that changed. In Boston, I remember the fee scale was exceedingly high. And I think as long as I can remember, the Boston endodontists were getting maybe $100 for an anterior and $250 and then $300 and $400 for a molar. That was a much more rapid jump in fee than anything that happened in Philadelphia. Somehow or other, Philadelphia endodontists were slow to raise fees. I'm not saying that was good or bad, but that was the trend at the time. That was the times. And strangely enough, I was the first one to limit my practice to endodontics. And I think that was in 1952. Although Dr. Grossman and Drs. Grossman and Bender were leading lights in endodontics, neither one had limited practice. And I reached the point where I was running about 50% general practice and about 50% referral practice for endodontics, and I realized that I couldn't go on that way. And I had to come to a decision. And at that time, I was in the early 50s, I was taking a course in practice management in New York. It was called the New Organization School for Practice Management. I used to go there once a week. And part of the course was analysis of the practice and the direction it was taking. And I remember my counselor saying, you know, you're about ready to limit your practice. Well, that was a frightening thing to me, because to give up general practice meant cutting half my practice out, and I had no idea how long it would take before I could manage a living on a limited practice. But yet, I realized that I couldn't go on the way I was because there was too much pressure from doing both general practice and endodontics, and also general practice at that time was already becoming oriented toward more fixed bridge work and occlusal reconstruction, and that's time-consuming and demanding. So when they pointed out to me that they thought I could make a go of it in limited practice, I took the plunge. And I was amazed that they predicted that it would take about a year before I could make the transition into making a good living at it. I was amazed that within 3 months' time, after I announced limitation of practice, I had a full schedule in endodontics alone. And I think from that point on, we began to get more endodontists in the Philadelphia area. I remember George Stewart opened up soon after that in limited practice, and then Cy Oliet came along and Leonard Paris, and shortly, within about 5 years, we must have had about 20 endodontists in the Philadelphia area. And the feeling, another great thing that changed in the trend of thinking in the 60s was that for you to have succeed in endodontics, you had to be in a big metropolitan area. So all the endodontists were around the Philadelphia area, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, the big metropolitan areas, and we thought that that's the only way you could make a go of it. You needed to have 200 or 300 dentists that were sources of referral to make your practice go. We soon found out, through the efforts of a few hardy individuals who were willing to open up in smaller communities, that that wasn't true. And that was sort of an eye-opener, to me at any rate. I remember some men opening up in areas where the population was maybe 100 to 200,000 people, and I said, they'll never make it. And I was shocked to find that they not only made it, but they made it big. You didn't need 200 dentists to refer to you. You could make a living very comfortably on 25 to 30 dentists. And of course, we've seen that that's true, that now the large areas are not only overpopulated with endodontists, and large metropolitan areas I'm talking about, like New York, Philadelphia, Miami, Los Angeles, and so on, but and Boston, of course, they're not only overpopulated with endodontists, but they're not even, most cities are not desirable areas to live in anymore. You know what's happening in the country, there's a lot of poverty and unrest in the cities. Philadelphia is a good illustration of a ghetto area where it's not safe to walk the streets at night. And I don't blame a young man who's going out into a practice to get away from this and to go into an area where he feels he can live safely and have his children grow up in safety, go to school, have good transportation and so on. So there is a trend away from the metropolitan areas. Now that may reverse itself in time, but we'll have to wait to see. But the young endodontist today can still go into almost any area in the country and make a good living. And I don't think we've reached the full saturation point in endodontics, although I predict that that will come maybe in the next 10 years or so. We'll be overpopulated with endodontists. And of course, endodontists will be, if my prophecy will be fulfilled, that caries will eventually be licked and periodontal disease will be on the decline as well, there'll be no need for endodontists. But I think the young endodontist today will still has a future.
When you said that you were the first one to limit your practice, do you mean in Philadelphia or...?
Yes, in Philadelphia. There were a few men throughout the country that were already limited. Not too many, though. As a matter of fact, when the American board, you alluded to this before, incidentally, and I didn't answer it. They said, did I have any formal training in endodontics? There were no formal training in endodontics. Men were self-trained. And when the American board was first formed, which was in the early 60s, they had to start from a base, and they took 25 men who were called the founders. And they were automatically given their boards, and I was one of the 25 founders. And I had no formal training. I was self-taught. I think whatever reputation I had in endodontics came about through my publications. And I was giving a lot of postgraduate courses, and that's how I became known in the field. And we had very few formally organized training programs in endodontics.
When was this?
This was in the early 60s. I remember there were a few programs around for advanced training, but they had no meaning in the sense that there was no recognition by the Council on Dental Education. So as a result of the efforts of a handful of men, a board was formed, and founders were given their boards, and efforts were made in the political arena to get the American Dental Association to agree that endodontics would be a specialty, and sure enough, it was agreed upon as of 1965, when the American Board of Endodontics was recognized, and endodontics was first recognized as a specialty. And from that point on, of course, examinations were given, but we had a lot of so-called grandfathers, people who had been practicing endodontics who had no formal training. And some mechanism had to be made for them to be boarded officially. They were given examinations which were not the same caliber of exam as we would give today. It was not until after the board was established, that regulations could be established dealing with the educational requirements. And we now know that it takes a two-year program, a minimum 2 years, to be recognized as board eligible. So endodontics has come a long way, and now there are at least 40 or 50 programs in the United States, formal programs which are recognized by the American Dental Association, accredited programs. And even so, the number of applicants for the programs far exceeds the number of places available. Although I predict that this will gradually change.
What type of anecdotal type of experiences can you recall, or really humorous type of things that kind of stick in your mind during the course of your endodontic practice? How did you come across things like English sparrow droppings?
Well, that was, of course, the English sparrow droppings was a very humorous story that I picked out of the literature. In reviewing the history of endodontics, and it's always interesting that when you go back into the history of any field, that the things that you believe are so new and modern and far-reaching have already been thought about by your forebears. And there really isn't anything new that we do today that hasn't been done or thought about 50 or 100 or 200 years before. As a matter of fact, it's a shock sometimes if you take the old standard classic textbook of operative dentistry by Black, and you look in the Black's textbook, which was written, 75 years ago, you find all the modern endodontic procedures described very nicely, including hemisections and root amputations and endoperio treatments. Everything that we think that we're doing, we're so clever about today, our forebears thought about them a long time ago. Now, when I was looking through the history of endodontics, I came across this article by Hunter, where he used, this was apparently a paper that was given at a dental meeting, and someone asked him what was the best treatment for pulp capping, and he very facetiously talked about using sparrow droppings. Of course, what he was implying was that there were so many different remedies for pulp capping that it really didn't make any difference what you used. You would, clinically, you could get success. And he was illustrating this in a very humorous way, and I don't think it was ever intended to be taken seriously, although maybe some people did. But that's the history of endodontics. As you go through the literature in the field, you find that so many different drugs and treatments that have been recommended over the years that it can literally make your head swim. And pulp capping is one illustration. Cavity sterilizing agents is another. That is root canal, intracanal medicaments. We've got a myriad of root canal medicaments. Everyone swears by their own pet sterilizing agent. We've got a whole host of irrigating solutions, and of course various techniques for filling root canals and various materials, which indicates that there isn't one universally accepted method or treatment modality, and I guess that's the way it should be. As long as we can continue to investigate, someone's always going to come up with a better mousetrap. But interestingly enough,
let me interrupt you for a minute. Yeah. Is this Hunter the same Hunter that was the focal?
No, that's a different Hunter. Same name, of course. No, the one that the hunter that came out with the bloodbath was not even a dentist. He was a physician. This hunter was a British investigator. Incidentally, along those lines, we're talking about everything that was thought about by our predecessors. We find the same thing is true today if we go into the history of pain control remedies, and I'm very much interested in this now. I've sort of evolved from the mechanical aspects of endodontics, which I have to admit are rather boring at this particular time. although it was necessary to go through that era, into treatment of pain, prevention of pain, and understanding the psychological components of pain, we find the placebo effect as a powerful force in controlling pain. And when you look at the history of the placebo effect, you find that even in dentistry, toothaches could be treated by placebo. And this is humorous, when you ask me about some of the humorous anecdotes. Back in the 17th century, toothaches were treated by taking a worm, which was called by an Italian physician, Dr. Rinaldo Gerbi, Curriculo anti-odontolyticus. And he said, the way you treat a toothache is to take this worm and crush it between the thumb and forefinger into a paste, rub it into a paste, and then rub that over the affected part, and that would cure a toothache. And sure enough, an investigatory commission was appointed to check into the claims for this miraculous cure, and they found that it was 75% correct. Now, that wasn't the end of it. A few years later, Dr. Calderoni, who was a court physician at Weimar, said, well, let's substitute something that's a little bit more pleasant. And he said, take a ladybird and do the same thing. Rub it between the thumb and forefingers and then rub that on the affected tooth, and you will get reduction and elimination of toothache. And that was found to be at least 75 to 80% effective after a year afterwards. Now, after that, there were plenty of other remedies that were recommended for toothache. I remember one where it was even recommended by a man called Volghese that the patient rinse with their own urine. And there was one British investigator who said the way to cure a toothache is to have the patient take a mouthful of milk and shake his head until the milk turned to butter and the toothache would go away. So the placebo effect is present in all areas of investigation, certainly in pain control. And I firmly believe that many of the treatments that we use today are effective because of placebo effect. That is, the investigator wants to believe in them and does. That belief is transferred to the patient believes in it, and they're effective. As you well know, even a sugar pill will be effective for pain control at least one-third of the time. And that was shown by Beecher and then many years ago. So pain is a fascinating area, and I think the endodontist today, incidentally, is going to be dealing with this and with diagnosis of painful conditions in the oral cavity and the head and neck area, more so than most other practitioners, because in the old days, by the old days I'm talking about 25, 30 years ago, it was the oral surgeon who was the diagnostician. That is, when a dentist got into trouble with a patient who had vague head and neck pain, and he could not make a diagnosis, he would send the patient to the oral surgeon. And unfortunately, what would happen is, any surgeon, his prime thought is about surgery. So the treatment for pain is, in the case of dentistry, extracting a tooth. In the case of a surgeon, it would be removal of appendix or a gallbladder or a D&C or what have you. And however, I'm glad to see that this is gradually changing, and I think the endodontist will become the diagnostician of head and neck pains for the future, or should, providing he has the proper training and background. And that's where our advanced programs come into play. If our advanced programs are sufficiently well diversified, the diagnostic abilities of endodontists will be so good that when vague head and neck pains are brought in by patients, it'll be the endodontist, theoretically, who will be able to make that diagnosis. So I view the future as being an endodontist should be trained in a multidisciplinary way by neurologists, psychiatrists, pharmacologists, psychiatrists, and he will get an overall view of both the physiological and the psychological components of pain. And he'll be much better equipped to deal with the diagnostic aspects, and of course treatment if it involves the dental pulp, which are the main reasons for head and neck pain, incidentally, the usual reasons. But, you know, we get a lot of patients who have atypical facial pains. We get patients with various neuralgias. We get patients with systemic conditions like coronary disease, referring pains to the teeth, and the endodontist has to be aware of this.
Okay, let me ask you one more question. What were the early attitudes and resistances that you came across as far as doing endodontic treatment in the early days when you started doing it?
Well, I think one of the problems that we ran into initially was that we didn't have confidence ourselves in our ability to save certain teeth. Teeth with curvatures and calcifications, various types of obstructions were difficult to treat. We didn't know how to handle them. We had a fear of doing periapical surgery anywhere else but in the anterior part of the mouth. Posterior surgery was a risk. We weren't trained for it. Now, of course, the modern endodontic student is trained in surgery for all teeth, and I think that's one of the major advances that we've learned. We used to be afraid to go into the sinus, for instance, operate on molars for fear of going into the sinus. We now know that that's not too serious a complication. And we train our students to do surgery on lower molars, even though there may be a thick cortex, we still can do it. So that I think that's a major advance. In the old days, we were afraid to do this. So teeth that were involved where surgery could not be done were sacrificed. And I think that was one of the great fears we had in the old days. Also, endodontists or dentists, I think traditionally, always felt on the defensive as far as success or failure was concerned. That we felt that we had to turn out work that would succeed almost for the lifetime of the patient. Whereas I don't think the physician ever felt that way. And not even the automobile mechanic or the refrigerator people or people who made appliances ever felt that appliances had to live for a lifetime, work for a lifetime. Somehow or other, the dentists are a peculiar breed who feel that whatever they do has to last for the lifetime of the individual. So we'd feel guilty if something we did would fail within a few years. And I think that's part of maybe the perfectionism that with which one brings into the field, or the precision that we're taught that everything has to be perfect, or maybe philosophically our attitudes in education are wrong, that we have to have 100% success. I don't agree with that. Biologically, that's impossible to achieve. But if our students are taught that this is what's expected of them, then they begin to feel very defensive about any failure that occurs, which means they have to be perfect. And you know that's a hard thing to be. It's almost impossible. If you have to be perfect, you're going to spend a lifetime of regret and fear.
Who would you say, just as an aside, would be the people that you feel I could get more information from that would go back and